Hello and welcome to a special edition of Inside the NYPD, the official podcast of the New York City Police Department. We are broadcasting from police headquarters in Lower Manhattan to our listeners around the world. I'm Jesse Peterman. This week, a special edition of the podcast. We bring you an interview with Police Commissioner Raymond W. Kelly and William Finnegan of the New Yorker magazine. Finnegan was the author of Defending the City, an article about the department's counterterrorism efforts. As part of the New Yorker's Festival of Writers and their subjects, Finnegan and Commissioner Kelly sat down before an audience in Times Square to discuss counterterrorism and intelligence. We now present to you Commissioner Raymond Kelly and Bill Finnegan at the New Yorker Festival.
Ray Kelly was born and raised right up here on the Upper West Side in the days when that part of town was a lot less genteel. I think West Side Story, Jets and the Sharks. He swears that play was about his block. He joined the police as a cadet and is the only person ever to rise from the bottom to the top at the NYPD, from cadet to commissioner. In the 1960s, he enlisted in the U.S. Marines, spent a year fighting in Vietnam, where he worked as a forward artillery observer, one of the more dangerous combat posts. He remained in the Marine Corps Reserves till 1996, when he retired as a colonel. In the NYPD, he's held 25 different commands, so it's safe to say that there's no one who knows a lot more about policing New York than he does. Somewhere in there, he found the time to earn a wall full of degrees, including law degrees from St. John's and NYU, and a master's from Harvard. And just how he and his wife, Veronica, also raised two well-adjusted, successful sons is a complete mystery. Now, Ray Kelly is also the only person ever to hold the job of police commissioner twice. His first time around was under Mayor David Dinkins from 92 to 94. This tour began when Michael Bloomberg became mayor at the beginning of 2002. Between his stints as commissioner, he kept busy. He commanded the multinational police force that went into Haiti in 1994. He was at Interpol, the international police organization, from 1996 to 2000, serving as vice president for the Americas. In the Clinton administration, he was an undersecretary at the Treasury Department, responsible for enforcement bureaus, including the U.S. Customs Service, the U.S. Secret Service, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Then, in a move that was pure Kelly, he asked for a demotion. He wanted to become customs commissioner, a job that reported to him and paid less money. Now, he wanted to do that partly because he'd be closer to the action and partly because the customs service seemed to him to be in serious need of a shakeup. He got his wish, got his demotion, and the customs service got its shakeup. From which I gather it still hasn't recovered, which is a good thing. And that's actually a pretty interesting story, but perhaps not one we'll get to today. In 2001, Kelly went into the private sector for the first time since, I don't know, he was a publishing house messenger as a teenager.
That's right.
He became director of global security for Bear Stearns, the investment bank. And that's where he was on September 11th. After the terror attacks, he felt, he told me, kind of maddeningly confined to the sidelines. He was out of the game, as he put it, and he wanted back in. Soon enough, Michael Bloomberg, then mayor-elect, made him an offer he couldn't refuse, another big pay cut. And that's where I'd like to take up the story, with the situation you found yourself coming into, taking on the police commissioner's job just 3 or 4 months after 9/11, because that, I probably should have mentioned before, is really the theme of this conversation today as I see it. you know, policing New York in this post 9/11 world. So what was it like coming in this time?
Well, it was obviously a daunting challenge because the department was not focused on terrorism. It was something that was really alien to policing. I knew that we had to do something to focus the department on the issue. So before I actually took the office, I had meetings with some close confidants and started doing planning right in Bear Stearns. And I decided to create the Counterterrorism Bureau, something we never had before. And that was really the vehicle to focus the department. Also to revamp and reinvent our intelligence division, which was, up until that time, basically an escort service for VIPs, doing very little intelligence gathering, primarily criminal intelligence work, but it was low level. And we did a series of other things. We created a position of our own doctor, our own endocrinologist, to be able to interact with the health community, to talk the talk, so to speak. So we sort of drew up all of these diagrams, took office on January 1st of 2002, hit the ground running, created the Counterterrorism Bureau very quickly, had recruited Frank Labuti. My Marine Corps background, I was looking for former Marines, and Frank Labuti was a well-known Lieutenant General in the Marine Corps, had just retired. I reached out to him, and he decided to move from he was in the State Department at the time, come to the department and head our counterterrorism operations. I reached out to David Cohn. David was someone who was famous in the intelligence community, certainly here in New York, but had left the CIA after 35 years of service. I knew he was at AIG. I was hoping he felt similar to me, that it was kind of out of the game, and guess what, he did. So he agreed to join the department in a totally, you know, newly constructed role. Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence, Deputy Commissioner of Counterterrorism for Frank Labuti. Now, these were two functions, or at least one function, intelligence, that was way down in the organization when I went there. We had a Joint Terrorist Task Force component working with the FBI. On September 11, 2001, there were 17 investigators in our component of the Joint Terrorist Task Force, and it was sort of buried in the Detective Division. Moved it up, put it as an integral part of the Counterterrorism Bureau, and, of course, the new Deputy Commissioner, reporting directly to me, both deputy commissioners. The Counterterrorism Bureau had the Joint Terrorist Task Force function. Now it consists of 130 New York City detectives working with the FBI. It had a counterterrorism survey and advisory function to major buildings, landmarks, structures in New York City, and also had a function of developing curriculum for the entire department. So those three functions in the Counterterrorism Bureau and the Intelligence Division, I said to David, hey, let's make this a intelligence gathering and analysis entity. And we went to work. Dr. Danny Zavadsky joined us as the endocrinologist. She's located in the Counterterrorism Division. We started to do a series of things, probably later on, maybe 6 months into 2002, June, July, August. We started to do some unique things on patrol, using heavily armed officers, the Hercules teams that you wrote about, and moving them throughout the city, things that had been done before in municipal policing. I was concerned about what the reaction would be to the public. It was something you saw in Europe, heavily armed officers mm-hmm. on the streets. You didn't see it in this country. People were very positive. I got a lot of positive feedback as a result of that. So a lot of things started to emanate from the putting in place of a new counterterrorism bureau and the restructuring of the intelligence division.
I wonder, yeah, I think a lot of people see the 9/11 attacks as having been kind of a one-off, you know, something unpreventable, at least by anybody here in New York, something unrepeatable, something unprecedented. But how do you see 9/11? That is, you know, in what context, you know, Al-Qaeda and New York?
Yeah. Well, now, you know, hindsight is 20/20. I see it as part of an ongoing war that we were engaged in for quite a while, but we didn't know it. Al-Qaeda wanted to come here. In fact, I was a commissioner in 1993 when we had the first World Trade Center bombing. We didn't know the genesis of that, that it was determined to be this radical sheikh, came here after the problems in Egypt in 1990, came to the U.S., was this motivating factor that coalesced six or seven people to come together and fill a truck with ammonium nitrate and drive it into the World Trade Center. It was really seen as nothing more than that. Mm-hmm. It was no linking to international terrorists, some mild talk, but we didn't get the picture in 1993. That event was linked to the Nusayr killing of Maya Kahani in 1990. We didn't know that then, and indeed the police department in 1990 wanted to characterize that incident as a just this one aberrant individual shooting Maya Kahani, when in fact that was part of the Al-Qaeda plot, this international effort to come here and strike us, hurt the economy, kill Americans, but we didn't see it. So the 2001 events, the 9/11, was simply part of a continuum of a kind of a perpetual war that's been going on for a long time with radical extremists, certainly wanting to hurt America, but other Western countries as well.
And how about since 9/11?
Since 9/11, the situation has adjusted somewhat, but hasn't fundamentally changed. I think the obviously with us going into Afghanistan, it's disrupted those training sites. They're no longer there. The war in Iraq, some people argue, has coalesced and brought the terrorists together, working in one spot. But if you move Iraq and Afghanistan to the side, there have been 20 major terrorist events since 9/11 throughout the world. So the war continues, and radical Islamic the extremists continue to want to come here. We believe, the intelligence community believes, that New York is the top of the terrorist target list, that if they could come here, they certainly would.
Have there been, since September 11th, any significant failed plots against New York?
Well, one that we talk about a lot is the Ayman Ferris plot. Ayman Ferris was a naturalized U.S. citizen. He had fought in Afghanistan with bin Laden against the Russians in the 80s. He comes here in the 90s, becomes a citizen in the late 90s, lives in Ohio, is a hazmat material truck driver. In the year 2000, goes to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen, spends time with bin Laden. In 2002, after being tasked by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, certainly a top lieutenant of Osama bin Laden, he comes here to plot to take down the Brooklyn Bridge. And he kept coming back to the bridge. He reconnoitered it and looked at ways of taking it down with cutters, cable cutters. But after a period of time, he signaled back to his handlers that the weather was too hot. The security that we had in place, indeed we had security right on the Brooklyn Bridge at that time, was too hot. Now, how do we find out about this? Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is taken into custody in March of 2003 in Pakistan. So he gives it up. He gives up Ayman Ferris. Ayman Ferris is arrested by the FBI. He was convicted, sentenced to 20 years in, it was early 2004, and he's in prison here in the U.S. Then we had other plots. We had the Paracha plot, which is a little murkier, but Paracha, there's a father and a son, both of them Pakistani nationals. The father had an import business here in Manhattan. He and his son, it was alleged and actually proved, his son is still in jail, and Paracha Sr., I believe, is in Guantanamo Bay, were working with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to import, we believe, explosives into the United States in containers under the guise of imports with his import company. We found out about Paracha through Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Of course, both individuals were taken into custody. Then we had the plot last year. Two individuals, one Pakistani-born, the other one a U.S. Citizen born of an Egyptian father and a U.S. mother, who were working in a bookstore near a mosque. And under our intelligence division, we had cultivated a fair number of confidential informants, obtained information about the kind of volatile rhetoric that this one young man in particular was espousing, and becomes more and more of a concern. Then starts to talk about killing large numbers of people. We get closer to him with our confidential informant. He goes, or they both go, and they start making maps of targets in New York. One of these individuals lives in Staten Island, so they made maps of all three police stations in Staten Island and also Fort Wadsworth. Then they decide that they want to do something in the subway system, the transit system. They pick out the Herald Square subway station, which is about 12 blocks from here, and they go and they make a map of the subway station, and they reconnoiter it. They go themselves to the station. They buy backpacks, and they have no explosives, but they're plotting and scheming ways to get the explosives. Now, this is happening in mid-August of last year. Mm-hmm. So we're working with the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District, and collectively decide we should take this case down because the Republican National Convention is starting August 29th. We're just now about a week away, so we arrest both of these individuals. Now, they had no explosives, but we're not certain how they're going to act out, mm-hmm. what they might have done in that regard. So these are three plots that mm-hmm. we have a lot of information about. Mm-hmm. We don't know what else we've prevented, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. we believe that that we have.
This last one you're describing, the Herald Square subway station plot, did those guys seem to have any connection to international organizations, or were they what
right.
you call lone
yeah.
wolves?
Well, that's a good question, because they did not. They uh-huh. had no known connection to an international organization, and this is a cause for concern. What we have mm-hmm. to worry about, the individuals who get together, who hear this very emotive rhetoric, who are energized to do something, to act mm-hmm. out, and the so-called lone wolf theory.
We
have listening posts throughout the city and other places that help us try to identify groups or people who are, perhaps talking along this line. But no indication that they were directly connected to any international organization. But Al-Qaeda is a philosophy. It's a movement. It's much broader than just one organization. They have mm-hmm. influence mm-hmm. certainly throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. If we could talk a bit about the NYPD's particular initiatives. I'm sure people have got the idea that there's been this fundamental reorganization since Commissioner Kelly came in three and a half years ago, where there were fewer than two dozen officers working the terrorism beat full-time before 9/11. There are now about 1,000, and that's full-time. Now, a lot of people seem surprised to learn that there are NYPD detectives stationed overseas, working directly with foreign police departments and security services in England, France, Israel, Singapore, Canada, and filing daily reports. What's that about?
Well, those officers are our tripwires, our listening posts. We want to get any piece of information that can help us better protect New York. Obviously, their main focus is terrorism, counterterrorism, but also they can help in conventional crime as well. New York is, to us, the center of the universe anyway. So many things come through here. And so it's been very helpful. For instance, we have a detective, Morty Zdansky, who used to work, by the way, right in the precinct we are now as an investigator. He's in Tel Aviv, and he's been there now for about 2 years. He is really embedded with the Israeli police. Every time there is an event of suicide bombing in Israel, he's there within the hour. He sends back detailed reports. We have more information, I would think, certainly than any municipal agency, we know that, but we have this information, we share it with federal agencies. He's able to give us a sense and a pulse of what's happening over there. We have detectives in London, and they too are very much embedded with Scotland Yard. And on July 7th, when the London bombings took place in the subway, I was on the phone. Well, I was on the phone certainly earlier than 7 o'clock, but talking about the events. But I spoke to our detective there at 7 o'clock in the morning when I was in my office about all the specificity that he could tell us about what happened on the subway system. And as a result, we did things tactically in the city to better protect our transit system. Again, we didn't know if this was an international plot, if this was going to be a series of attacks in big cities. And our transit system looks very much like London's. Mm-hmm. And we look a lot like London, much more so, say, than other U.S. cities. So we have a close working relationship with London. But that's what our detective there was able to give us. Real-time information. We responded based on that information to deploy uniform officers, put procedures in place to better protect our transit system. And again, on the 21st of July, when there were attempted bombings, information immediately. That's when we decided on that day to put our bag searches in here and then mm-hmm. into transit system. And they're still going on. So I see it of value. It's certainly been of value to the department. We're not looking to push anybody aside. The FBI certainly, and of course the CIA, have an international role. We're just looking to augment, to supplement, mm-hmm. to get any piece of information that can protect New York. And in the case of the transit system, I mean, the federal government doesn't think like that. Mm-hmm. You know, we're thinking locally. We're thinking about things that can help us here in New York.
Mm-hmm. The way David Cohen, the Deputy Commissioner for Intelligence, put it to me was, we don't want to learn from what's happened here. We want to learn from what's happened somewhere else.
Absolutely.
Which sounds a little ghoulish, but the NYPD dispatch, besides the people who are stationed overseas, dispatches teams of investigators to the scenes of terrorist attacks virtually anywhere in the world, and starts, you know, went to Madrid, went to Philippines, went to Bali and many other places these last few years, looking for the kind of clues that we've been talking about. Speaking of the federal agencies, I think a lot of New Yorkers felt that various federal agencies really let down the city on September 11th. The FBI and the CIA, obviously, the FAA, the Pentagon. And the more some of us learn about the run-up to the attacks, the more we feel that way. And I think that the shame and embarrassment that many federal officials rightly felt after 9/11 provided the opening, psychologically and politically, for you and the NYPD to step up and become independently active in areas that were traditionally handled by federal agencies. You know, this deployment of overseas of NYPD detectives is just the most obvious example of that. I wonder, have you felt any particular backlash against your anti-terror initiatives? I mean, I've heard plenty of grumbling from federal officials myself, but I'm wondering if you felt anything more significant.
I've heard grumblings similar to you, but not on an official basis, not on a high level. I just had a meeting just this past week with Bob Mueller. Both we had a group meeting and also a one-on-one meeting, and he's supportive of what we're doing here. I think some of the things we're doing here could be helpful to the FBI, and we're working, I think, more closely together now than ever. So I can understand, this kind of knee-jerk turf protection reaction that some people may have had, but we're going to do it anyway. And and I think we're getting beyond that.
I wonder what you can say. I mean, there has always been a lot of tension between the FBI and the NYPD. And in fact, that's one of the reasons the first Joint Terrorism Task Force was formed here in New York back in 1980, you know, to get the two to start working together better. I know you have to be diplomatic about the FBI. Those cell phones that, you know, I mean, we might have a bomb squad come roaring in here or something. It's supposed to keep going on. Not really. And I know you have to, as I say, be diplomatic about the FBI. You work more closely with them than ever before, probably now. But what can you say about the differences between the two institutions, their cultures, their methods, their approaches to the work?
Well, the FBI has top-flight people. They hire the best of people. They have thousands of people wanting to become members of the FBI. They're very well-educated. And I think you even mentioned this in your article. Most of them, of course, come from outside of New York City. It's difficult to learn about New York in a relatively short period of time that many of them spend here. Most of our investigators, on the other hand, certainly the majority of people still in the department still live in New York City. If not, they live in the immediate suburbs and have family that lives in New York City. So they know the city better than someone who hasn't been born here or lived here. And they do a lot more criminal investigations. That's what we do. You know, we do that. That's our business. So I think our investigators are more experienced in certainly in the things that we're concerned about here in New York City. And we've been able to take that investigative talent, I think, and transfer it to our work in the Joint Terrorist Task Force, but also in the people that we assign overseas. They've worked investigations. They know how to get information about investigations that are going on in other places. But so there is a difference in culture. There's a difference in who we recruit. The difference of who we put on the street. And their mandate, I guess, is a little broader than ours as far as the federal rules and regulations that they enforce. We are enforcing, primarily the penal law here. And I think, there's nothing like an experienced New York City detective. The volume of cases that we have, the volume of things that you handle as a detective in a detective squad, you're catching cases by the clock, they call it. In other words, you're catching anything that walks in from 4 o'clock at night to 1 o'clock in the morning. It's coming in, that's your case. That doesn't happen in the federal government. I had my own federal experience, so I know how they work. Much of what they do is controlled by the U.S. attorney. If they don't want to take a case, the U.S. attorney, that is, it just isn't taken. That's as simple as that. Well, in municipal policing, certainly in this city, you catch, as I say, by the clock. You don't have the option of saying, I don't want to investigate that. As a result, I believe it builds up investigative skills. And we have top-flight investigators throughout the department, not only in the Detective Division, Organized Crime Control Bureau, that's Narcotics Division, and our Vice Division, Counterterrorism Bureau now, Intelligence Division. So I think we're very fortunate in that regard. They're just kind of apples and oranges in a way. Federal investigators and New York City police detectives.
That was diplomatic, I thought. I think not too many New York cops knew when they joined the force that they were signing up to fight Al-Qaeda. But the job, as cops still call it, has really been overhauled in the last, say, 3.5 years to include a strong element of counterterrorism. That's for everybody. Now, has this been resented in the rank and file? Has it been resisted? Have people quit over it, do you think?
Not at all. And, we've hired 10,000 police officers in the 3.5 years, 3 years, 9 months of Bloomberg administration. But so that means still a majority of members of the department were here on 9/11 and were involved in some way, shape, or form with September 11. I think that was a great motivating factor. New York City police officers see themselves on a mission to protect the city from international terrorism. And the changes that we made have been beneficial to the officers in real terms. We've created the Counterterrorism Bureau, more opportunities for promotion, more detectives, more overtime, which everybody likes. So I think it's a win-win. I've heard no grumbling at all. And there was this, initially people thought there would be, because this is, culture-bound organization, resist change. Most organizations resist change. I think here there was very little resistance. It's also a hierarchical organization. And whoever's sitting in the commissioner's chair, the organization follows. They may be grumbling or, you know, under the breath type of complaints, but that wasn't the case in the organization. They do it anyway, but it just wasn't the case.
Why did the Pentagon recently have to borrow 17 computer-literate Arabic speakers from the NYPD to assist its intelligence arm? You know, why can't the CIA, the FBI, the Pentagon come up with their own agents and operatives who are fluent in the Middle Eastern and South Asian languages most critical to contemporary counterterror work?
Well, I think they have to look at their hiring practices, but here we're the beneficiary of being in the most diverse city in the world. We have tremendous a pool of talent as far as language capability is concerned. And we're also able, through a process called selective certification, to reach down on the eligible list. In other words, I sign up, I want to be a police officer, I take the examination. You get on the eligible list. Well, you can reach down and pick up, take somebody right to the top of that list if they have a particular skill, language being one. So we've been able to do that. We've cultivated, identified, nurtured our own language, internal language capability, and hired additional people that have that capacity. So now, and what we've done is we've taken people who claim to have certain languages, and we've tested them, language skills. We've tested them. We've taken them to Berlitz, and they come back and tell us at what level they're able to communicate. So we have over 60, now these are police officers, over 60 uniform Arabic speakers. We have Urdu, Pashto, Hindi, Farsi speakers. So we simply have more than any federal agency that I'm aware of, certainly law enforcement officers. So it is a very talented pool. We work closely with the Defense Intelligence Agency, and they weren't shy, and I commend them for it, because, you know, there might be some resistance in Washington having that happen, but they said, hey, we could use your folks, and we lent them to them. So again, it's another win-win situation. And we use our language capability, obviously, to translate on the street where it's appropriate, or to work on the computers regarding chat rooms. There are certain chat rooms in various languages that we're interested in, and we have people who have this native ability to communicate. And in a lot of these chat rooms, Al-Qaeda type, sympathetic chat rooms, they give tests. They ask questions as to whether or not you really know Karachi or some place like that. And our people, many of whom were born there, can in fact, answer those questions. So it gives us the credibility. We had one case about 2 years ago. Two individuals were taking pictures of a transit tracks in on the 7 train in out near Flushing. And a police officer saw them do that. They're taking an inordinate amount of time taking pictures of tracks. He went up to them, and they claimed not to speak English, that they, in fact, were Iranian. And that was their defense, so to speak. Well, we were able to produce very quickly a Farsi-speaking police officer responded, interrogated them, found out ultimately that they were intelligence officers from Iran, and they were in 10 days deported out of the country as persona non grata. So we used our language skills. That's kind of a in the weeds story, but we're going to continue to cultivate those skills and use them in a variety of ways.
I actually met that guy, he's a detective. I'm interviewing him about something else, and he was talking about how he convinced these guys. He was a school teacher just coming in to, shoot the breeze with these guys. That poor guys didn't speak English, and soon enough, all this stuff came out. He actually works, I don't know how much I should say about this, in a cyber intelligence unit, doing this sort of penetration of jihadist chat rooms, insofar as that can be done, and it's quite an amazing occupation. These guys from, as you say, Karachi or Cairo, who can speak the sort of street idiom of Cairo in a place where you really need to pass all these tests, and at a certain point get invited into a deeper, more serious, you know, chat room. And I don't know if you want to say anything more about that. It's very sensitive work, obviously, but it's pretty fascinating stuff.
No.
That's what I expected. But since we're on this subject, jihadis and such, Salafist jihadis, you know, a category that includes al-Qaeda, talk about the near enemy and the far enemy, by which they mean their local opponents in the Middle East and their distant opponents in the West, particularly the U.S. Observing the NYPD's counterterror work, I've been struck by a similar kind of double focus. You know, both the Counterterrorism Bureau and the Intelligence Division are engaged in these extensive, you know, real-time studies of jihadist movements in Europe, North Africa, Mideast, South Asia, Southeast Asia, you know, virtually all over the world, looking for anything that's changing and possibly pointing toward New York. Michael Sheehan, who's now the Deputy Commissioner for Counterterrorism, said to me, when things went to hell in Egypt in 1990, it showed up here, referring to the Blind Sheikh and those bomb plots and so on. Now, at the same time, the NYPD is keeping very close tabs on Islamist militant groups, and other potentially violent movements, individuals, you know, so-called lone wolves, so-called sleeper cells, here in New York City and anywhere nearby. So I'd like to get your assessment, insofar as you can be specific, of the state of play in both arenas. First, the far enemy, al-Qaeda, and its many Salafist jihadi allies.
Well, we do watch what happens throughout the world. And I should have mentioned Michael Sheehan. He's now our deputy commissioner of counterterrorism. Very impressive person. Was very fortunate to have him. A member of the Bush 1 and Clinton NSC staff, former ambassador-at-large for counterterrorism at the State Department, former Special Forces officer. So under Michael Sheehan and David Cohn, we've been able to bring on board some top-flight analysts, young people from top schools, Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts, the Harvard Kennedy School, Columbia University, young, enthusiastic people who, many of them are, several of them were going to the federal government to work and be analysts there, but decided to come here because, as David Cohen says, they're working closer to the ground, and they're doing real-time work. So they look afar, you might say, and help us get a sense of what's going on in the rest of the world and how it might impact on us, and they do some very well-done, in-depth work, and Bill mentioned Salafism, which is a fundamentalist view of Islam that says, in essence, everything since Muhammad and Abu Bakr, the founder of Islam, kind of has gone awry. It's just not right. You got to get back to basics, and that's the core belief of many of the extremists, and Wahhabism, which you may have heard about, is kind of an offshoot of Salafism. So we have a very well done study on Salafism by our own analysts. They're viewing the world as a whole, trying to take what's happening out there and apply it to New York. And they synthesize, they bring together intelligence information that we gather here, that our own investigations have developed, investigations that we're looking at in New York City and perhaps other places as well. So they're looking afar, and we're doing, with our detectives and undercover operatives and confidential informants, we're looking at what's happening on the ground here. But it is kind of synthesized and brought together in a very effective way. The studies that they're doing are now being distributed to the federal government, and they're very appreciative of it. We just did they put the finishing touches on a modus operandi document that looks at all of the major terrorist events that happen in the world and uses kind of a template and looks at it and says, this is what they did in this case, and this is what they did in this event. So you can see, you know, common strange. Well, this is very useful information. And so that I think is something also that is unique about our operations. They're energetic, they're very smart, and now they're producing their own very valuable intelligence documents that are going to the federal government. Those two views of the world are pulled together in our counterterrorism center, and both the intelligence operation and the counterterrorism operation.
And where do those trend lines that your analysts are picking up, where are those pointing? Oh my God! Excuse me.
Get demerits here for this.
Demotion.
When you say trend lines in terms of, you know, what do we see coming down the pike? Difficult to say. I think we look to London, for instance, and you look at second generation bombers. You look at the London bombers. They are British. Three of the four are British citizens of Pakistani descent. First generation comes in essence to Leeds in England, trying to make a better life for themselves. These are the children of those people, relatively well off. Siddiqui Khan, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan, sort of the leader of the suicide bombers, 30 years of age, has a job as kind of an assistant teacher in a school, has a wife and a child, got several trips to Pakistan. I believe he also went to Afghanistan. He goes with another bomber, Tanweer, his name is. He's 22, so you see there's an age, you know, difference here. They go together, and then there's two other bombers. Also, the third one is of Pakistani descent, but a British citizen. But the fourth one is a 19 years of age as well. Is a Jamaican, Jermaine Lindsay, who comes to the UK is not a citizen, but also goes to Pakistan. So they all kind of meet up in Pakistan, but they have this Leeds connection. What does that mean? Well, we're trying to figure it out. Certainly the British are trying to figure it out. We're working with them as well. But these are not people coming from a foreign country. And, you know, in the 9/11 attack here, again, it was this kind of thinking that we had that you send these reconnaissance teams to a target, and then the operators will come in from an outside country, conduct the operation, and obviously kill themselves. Here, this is a different event. Now we see Zawahiri, who is the number two guy in Al-Qaeda, claiming credit for the London bombings. How much influence did they have? Was it operational influence? Was it just philosophical or spiritual influence? We don't know. So we're trying to make sense out of that. These individuals also, did you may have seen the pictures in the paper just the other day, on June 28th, they did their own reconnaissance. They had pictures of them actually going into the subway system and together as a team, contrary to things that we were thinking about. So you say, where are the trend lines? I think we have to continue to look internally at this type of recruitment going on or transition or radicalization of young people who nothing in their background that would indicate radicalism. Now, the four or five attempted bombers on July 21st, a little different. They were a little more radical. And in fact, they're from East Africa, which is another twist, Eritrea and Somalia. Their background is different. But one of them spent 5 years in prison in the UK for robbery. So more of a something you might expect. More radicalization, more in prison. A lot of that happens. We know that. He's out on the sidewalk with pamphlets, that sort of thing. Someone you might suspect. But the four who actually kill themselves. The four suicide bombers would not be people that would normally be on your radar screen. Mm. So these are the types of things that we're looking at. And it's difficult to say where the trend lines are, but the mm-hmm. second and even third generation is of interest to us.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of these videotapes in London, I've always hated surveillance cameras, you know, closed circuit TV. You know, the whole idea of everybody being watched all the time by some invisible Orwellian Big Brother. In the wake of the London subway bombings, however, you know, seeing the crucial role played by surveillance videotapes in solving this case, I've obviously been given some pause on that question. And now we hear that the MTA is going to be spending $700 million on 1,000 linked video cameras and 3,000 sensors of various kinds. What sorts of new security measures, besides the famous random bag searches, have the London bombings inspired the NYPD to take? You know, if you can discuss.
Well, I like surveillance cameras. I like you. But I think that system the MTA is talking about is a long way off. They actually mm-hmm. just did that contract really was for a systems integrator. I think the technology really isn't there yet, but hopefully it will be. So I think it's going to take a while to get those cameras in place. We, by the way, have our own on-the-street program. We're starting off with 400 cameras in our borough commands, and they'll be focused in areas of concern, but primarily street crime areas. But I hope that's just the vanguard of a much bigger program to get a lot of cameras on the streets. As far as what we're doing, we try to change the face of what people see as far as our tactics are concerned. Cameras, yes, but you'll see right out here in the Midtown area, twice a day we have a major mobilization of radio cars, police cars coming from all over the city, maybe as many as 100 cars. Now, virtually no other city can do that. They'll come together, they'll be briefed, and they'll go to sensitive locations that we're concerned about on a daily basis. On business day, primarily. We'll do it in the morning, we'll do it in the afternoon. They won't necessarily go to the same location 2 days in a row, but they might. So we do that sort of thing to make anyone doing reconnaissance uncertain as to where we will be. We've got a lot of positive feedback from the so-called terrorist experts. We said before we're moving heavily armed officers around. Again, unpredictable as to where they'll be. We want to continue to change the face of what people see. There are sensors for technology is concerned. We have a BioWatch system here in place run by the federal government. It's checked twice a day where if there's any biological agents in the air, it'll be able to be identified. There's a syndromic system that monitors emergency rooms in the city. It's run by the Department of Health, but we are, you know, plugged into that system. So if in event there was a biological attack here, and you know, believe in most situations like that, it would take a while for us to see the effects of it. So we monitor emergency rooms and try to get a heads up on anything that may be developing. There's technology, more sophisticated sensors coming down the pike. There'll be sensors in the transit system, but they're really not there yet, and we have to be careful because you'll see a prototype that's out there. It'll be on television, but it's not really ready for deployment or has a lot of bugs in it, and there's a lot of people out there trying to sell equipment. There's Homeland Security money in great supply out there. And as a result, there's a lot of companies that are pushing a lot of things. And the technology is not really where you might think it is, if you just watch the news or read the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. It's not really deployable. So mm-hmm. shoe leather, you know, having boots on the ground, good intelligence information, and I'd say augmented by cameras. That's kind of where we are and where we want to go.
Speaking of Homeland Security money, you've been very critical of the Bush administration's failure since September 11th to help New York protect itself. You told me we're still defending the city pretty much on our dime. Now, the president and the new Homeland Security Secretary, Michael Chertoff, have said they understand the importance of shifting federal Homeland Security spending to a so-called threat-based formula, you know, rectifying this absurd situation in which in fiscal year 2004, Wyoming received $37 per capita, North Dakota received $30 per capita, and New York got $5. Among the 50 states, New York's per capita allotment was 48th. Now, what is going on, do you think? And is there any relief in sight?
Yeah, what's going on is business as usual in Washington. You know, all politics is local, or are local. And I've gone down there several times to testify. The mayor has gone down there, and there's this ongoing battle between the big city states and the more rural states over the Homeland Security dollar, and so far the smaller states are winning. They're winning by requiring higher minimums. Each state gets a certain amount of money. Now, what we're arguing for is a totally threat-based funding system. And how you determine threat is somewhat subjective. We understand that, but at least that's the starting point. But that's not what's happened. Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, has led a fight for the smaller states to kind of win the day so far in the Senate. And they're still fighting over things in the Senate and the House. The versions are different. But both of the versions, Senate and House, still call for significant minimums that go to every state. Now, you can make up these scenarios where, yes, every state has some threat, but it's a huge stretch. Somebody told me in Washington when I went down to testify that they were concerned about the tobacco crop being adulterated. So that's what's happening. They're taking care of their constituencies, and Congress is the House is actually closer to the ground in that sense. So that's why you go out to Wyoming and you'll see first class of protective gear and new equipment and fire trucks and everything else.
Uh-huh.
But I must say that Mayor Bloomberg has made certain that we're getting what we need, and we've spent almost $400 million in overtime last year. A lot of money, and some of it had to do with Republican National Convention. We got some additional money, and we do get some money for overtime, but it's not enough, because our position is we're protecting America's assets. We're protecting the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, landmarks, the financial center, the financial and communication capital of the world here. Something happens here, it's going to ripple throughout the world, and we don't think there's been enough recognition of that in Washington.
Mm-hmm. I asked the mayor how the city does pay the lion's share of this expanded counterterror budget, and asked him what his approach to it was, and he said it's just spend whatever it takes and we'll pay for it later, we'll figure it out later. On the politics, we'll open this up to the floor in a second, but I had a question about the politics of counterterror that raised by this. With a threat like this hanging over our heads, as it were, I think it's a real temptation for leaders to play what I'll call the politics of fear. And it's a temptation that I think the Bush administration has often not resisted. diplomatic? But, one of the main objectives of terrorists, of course, is to spread fear. Now, really, it's a threat that can't be eliminated. It can only be managed. There is no perfect security. So I wonder if you could say something about that balance, which seems to me to be very tricky, between vigilance and alarmism, between keeping the public informed and ready to alert you to possible threats and scaring people unnecessarily.
Yeah. Well, it's a difficult situation. The longer we go without being attacked, the more they'll, you know, a sense of complacency will kick in, and then there'll be efforts to reduce the resources and take the money. Certainly on a municipal level, no question about it. We have to balance the budget every year. But I can just see offices of management and budget type people saying, "Hey, come on, you spent $400 million on overtime. There's been no attack here in 5, 6, 7 years, and why are you?" You know, continue to deploy people the way you're deploying it. So it's difficult, you know, and I know just what you mean. I mean, people can pander and people can blow it out of proportion. But one of the clearly stated methods of Al-Qaeda is to kind of wait us out. You know, they have a lot of patience. And the war is a, you know, just a continual situation for them. They're going to just wait and wait and wait. They have a different timeline than we do. You know, Americans want instant answers, want to be able to measure things quickly. And the only measurement we have, as you said, is not being attacked. But they'll be, the longer that goes on, obviously, that's what we want. But the longer that goes on, the more pressure there'll be to change what we're doing, lower expenses. You know, there's always going to be a budget crisis in this city. Just the way it is. And so there's a balance, and what that balance is, I don't think you can define it precisely, but yes, there is a tendency to pander in some quarters, but there also is, I think, a necessity for keeping people aware of the threat that's out there.
It's a strange business. I mean, success in counter-terror work just means nothing happens, I think, you know.
That was New York City Police Commissioner Raymond W. Kelly being interviewed by New Yorker magazine author William Finnegan. Part of the New Yorker Festival, rebroadcast with the cooperation of the New Yorker magazine for NYPD podcast listeners. Before we end this edition of Inside the NYPD, a word on joining New York's finest. The NYPD offers a job with a future, a great place to serve, and a chance to advance. For more information, call 212-RECRUIT or visit us on the web at www.nypdrecruit.com. Thank you for listening to this special edition of the New York City Police Department podcast. For Inside the NYPD, I'm Jesse Peterman.